A pro-abortion professor has withdrawn from a leadership role at Notre Dame after fierce backlash over her appointment. And a traditionalist Catholic group is ready to incur formal schism by ordaining its own bishops without Vatican approval. The Papal Posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal are here with analysis. U.S.-Cuba relations are further strained after Cuba fires on a U.S. vessel, killing four, while cartel violence in Mexico rages on. Florida Congressman Carlos Jimenez and foreign policy expert Dr. Waleed Fares weigh in. President Trump delivered his State of the Union address this week with special guests, including the daughter of Jimmy Lai. Claire Lai is with us, as is Congressman Chris Smith. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over as we celebrate our 30th year. We have a great show for you this evening. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo or at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. The pro-abortion professor appointed to lead the Asian Studies program at the University of Notre Dame has withdrawn from that position, while the Society of St. Pius X has decided to move ahead with ordinations without Vatican approval. Back with their unique insight and analysis is the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. That announcement that Professor Osterman would withdraw from her appointment as head of the Asia Studies program was made by Dean Mary Gallagher at Notre Dame via email. What were your thoughts upon receiving the news? Father, I'll start with you.
No, I was very pleased because this was a big scandal and it was causing Notre Dame to lose its Catholic identity through a self-inflicted wound. So I'm glad that this professor has withdrawn, and now we have to pray that, you know, they'll put someone in that position who supports the Catholic position that it's wrong to kill unborn children.
Mm-hmm. Bob, in a statement, this Professor Osterman said, "At present, the focus on my appointment risks overshadowing the vital work the Institute performs, which should be allowed to continue without undue distraction." Bob, the effort to get the university to rescind this appointment was largely student-driven. I mean, there were some retired professors, history professor, Father Bill Miss Campbell, who appeared on this show earlier in February. Your thoughts on Professor Osterman's statement that she's really getting out of the kitchen because she doesn't want it to be a distraction from the work of the Institute?
Yeah, I don't think that the word withdrew was part of the official statement from Notre Dame. I think that that would have sounded a little bit problematic to some of the professors, some of the academic world. And obviously, Notre Dame has one eye on the larger academic world and doesn't want to look like it's caving to pressure. But they said that she decided not to go forward with what was going to happen. Now, that's all great. But the fact that the pressure from within the university and outside with many bishops had to be brought to bear to change this appointment is itself a terrible comment on the university. And now I think we need to see what's going to happen going forward. It damages reputation, as Father said. But at the same time, it kind of indicates that the university regards Catholicism as some sort of alien influence on its academic life when its mission is a Catholic mission. So, look, this is going to have to be pursued beyond the immediate change. It's a welcome change. We'll have to see who else is appointed. But I think Notre Dame needs to do a bit of soul-searching at this point.
Mm. Well, we spoke with Father Bill Miss Campbell when the news broke, Father. And, look, while he's happy that Professor Osterman made the decision to back off and not continue with this appointment, he was very concerned about the damage done to Notre Dame's Catholic identity. Father, then Bob, what needs to be done now to restore Notre Dame's reputation and Catholic identity, not only on campus, but in the minds of alumni and students and Catholics across the country?
Well, I think we need more than simply an email from a dean. I think the president of Notre Dame should address the academic community, the alumni, and then the broader nation and explain why this is happening. And is he pleased that it's happening? Because to treat this as simply falling upon the shoulders of the professor, there's got to be more recognition that it's not simply a decision by her. The university accepted that decision, so they have to explain why they accepted that decision. And of course, this leads to, as Bob says, the much broader question. Is this a university that supports the Catholic mission of education, which is to form people in the doctrine of Christ? And those who aren't Catholic who go there, they're going to receive the same formation. They're understanding that when you go to a Catholic university, you're going to be exposed to Catholicism. The idea that somehow
imagine that.
Notre Dame can... Yeah, Notre Dame can segment off religion from an appointment such as this. It proves that the university is at a crossroads. I think there's a very easy and good solution, which is to say, anyone in the academic administration and in the faculty who is opposed to Catholic teaching should not be teaching or administrating at that university.
Yeah. Bob, my thought when I read this today and saw the email, I thought, all the parties responsible for this appointment in the first place, which caused this trauma throughout the campus and the nation, they really should be examined and questioned.
Yeah, the problem here is twofold, I suppose. One is that her views were so extreme that a big place like Notre Dame, and by the way, there are lots of good people at Notre Dame still, not only students, but in the faculty and in the administration. We ought to say that. And they should be supported, and they should not be tainted by this terrible thing that happened. But her views were so aggressively pro-abortion, calling abortion as a tool of white supremacy and this other nonsensical stuff, that it beggars belief how this happened in the first place. I don't think that there's an easy fix for Notre Dame here. We know that Notre Dame, in some of its decisions, is as I said earlier, kind of looking to the Ivy League and, you know, the other peer institutions that they want to be able to compete with. But although that you can tolerate certain people in certain positions, I mean, I don't know, a professor of chemistry who has an odd view about abortion or IVF or something, you can tolerate that. But when you have someone who is actually a public advocate of positions that are so contrary to the Catholic Church, I don't see how any responsible administrator allows an appointment like that to be made. So that is the place at which really the rubber meets the road, and some kind of analysis and serious reconsideration of how appointments are made is going to have to be done.
Yeah, accountability to the benefactors, to the students, and to the loyal staff that really are responsible for this turnabout in this story. It really was we had the head of the pro-life organization, Anna Kelly, a few weeks ago, and then Father Bill Miscampbell, and they really were quietly driving this on campus. And look, they had a big victory here, so God bless them. The Society of St. Pius X, Father, is reportedly moving forward with new episcopal ordinations of bishops without Vatican approval. Now, the last time the SSPX did this, in 1988, Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre, the head of the society, and the bishops he consecrated were excommunicated. Are we about to see a repeat of that moment again?
Well, if they proceed to the illegal consecrations against the will of the Holy See, yes, they will be automatically excommunicated. The bishop who does the ordination and also those who receive it. And that's an automatic excommunication. The Holy See can then declare that they have incurred the penalty, which is a way to make publicly secure the fact that they are now in a state of schism. They've been warned that this is a schismatic act. So they cannot justify it by saying, well, we don't consider a schismatic act, therefore it isn't. No, the Holy See decides. And in this case, they're deciding very reasonably because the Society of Pius X has been in discussion for more than 40 years about resolving the issues they have with in the life of the church. And then for them to do this at this point is to basically say, we don't want any further discussions or further obedience. That's clearly a schismatic act.
Bob, at least two high-ranking cardinals, Cardinal Mueller, Cardinal Sarah, have issued warnings to the society about breaking unity with Rome. And basically they're saying, look, you have to obey the Holy See. Will they listen? On the other hand, you have Bishop Schneider saying there are forces in the Vatican that want these talks to break down. You say what?
Yeah, I was very encouraged that Cardinal Sarah and Cardinal Mueller publicly made those statements ahead of time. And I think that they're absolutely right. My worry here is I think that the society has actually made demands that they know cannot be satisfied. They want changes in the documents of Vatican II. And look, we can debate all we want what those problematic, and we know there are problematic passages in various documents of Vatican II, but they aren't going to be changed, and they certainly aren't going to be changed before July. And my further worry here is that this intransigence, and I don't know how any Catholic can take up a position outside of the authority of the Church, this intransigence by a Latin liturgy group, I fear, is going to have terrible consequences about the legitimate attempts to bring back the traditional Latin Mass that we've been seeing. I mean, all of these groups, including the SSPX, are growing, and it shows that there is an attraction to that type of liturgy at this point in the life of the Church. So I think Pope Leo and others need to pay attention to that. But they shouldn't be confusing an intransigent group that refuses what I think are just reasonable requests that they join the rest of the Church again and be subject to the Pope. They shouldn't confuse that with the more moderate groups that are just looking to restore the Latin Mass and to have it as an enrichment in our Church today.
Yeah, but Father, this is the heart of the issue. When Pope Francis banned the traditional Latin Mass in so many quarters of the Church, or at least made it something alien and like contraband, I think it energized these groups because their numbers are growing. They said, wait a minute, we have to be the counterbalance to all of this. Archbishop Georg Ganswein, Pope Benedict's longtime personal secretary, has made a direct public appeal to Pope Leo to lift the restrictions on the traditional Latin Mass imposed by Pope Francis. Father, when a man of that stature and that closeness to Benedict makes this kind of public plea, does it carry any weight in Rome, do you think?
I think it does, because Archbishop Genschwein is expressing the mind of a pope who had at his heart the promotion of the unity of the Church. That's why he lifted the excommunication of the bishops who had been ordained legally by Archbishop Lefebvre. That's why he issued Summorum Pontificum. That's why he spoke about mutual enrichment. In other words, he was trying to find in the life of the Church what is the best way to promote the Church's mission and its liturgical peace. Now, Pope Francis overthrew Summorum Pontificum, so he basically said, Catholics who regularly obey me, you have to obey me in this regard. And then he gave permissions to the Pius X Society to witness marriages and to hear confessions. He did it because he wanted to have valid sacraments. But in the meantime, he didn't make any demands on them to become obedient to him. So you have this unusual situation with those who are disobedient got rewarded. Those who are obedient were penalized. I think the solution here is, of course, for the Pius X Society to withdraw this threat. And I think Pope Leo should seriously convene people like Mueller and Cardinal Sarah and Genschwein, listen to them, and then reissue Summorum Pontificum so that we can return to a very peaceful situation. The only people who were promoting the end of the Latin Mass were those who had absolutely no sympathy for them and expressed no regret when people's rights were violated. We shouldn't listen to a group who has no sympathy for so many people.
Yeah, well, this is the point, Bob, of the whole exercise. Pope Francis basically came in and, with a stroke of the pen, said, this is no more. And he abolished Pope Benedict's great openness to the Latin Mass, allowing it in every parish in America and the world. And the pastor could make that decision under Summorum Pontificum. Pope Francis just abolished it, said that no longer applies. Why would it be so difficult for Pope Leo to abolish the banning of Traditionis Custodis that basically eradicated the Latin Mass in so many dioceses?
Well, as we've said before in this show and elsewhere, that his personal loyalty to Pope Francis is palpable. And I don't think he wants to openly even appear to rebuke what Pope Francis did. But he certainly could massage this. He's a, you know, a soft-spoken, you know, well-liked guy. He has a nice manner. He could kind of, you know, split the difference here and say, look, the situation we see has changed. We want to encourage people who, for whatever reason, decide they want to use the traditional Latin Mass, but are obedient to Rome. And that means that they, too, are going to be in conversation about theological points coming out of Vatican II. I think that, though the difference is so great with the SSPX, and I want to say I fear that the reaction against them is going to redound to the lack of benefit on the more moderate elements in the church. It doesn't have to be this way, but if you take up the position that the church over the last 50 or 60 years is simply illegitimate, which is what they, in effect, are saying, I don't see that there's any possible way to reconcile with that particular group. But let's be cautious that we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, because there's a lot of energy in a more traditional Catholicism.
Yeah, well, it's where the youth is. It's where the future is. I mean, you see it. You can walk in any of these parishes celebrating the traditional Latin Mass. It's all young people. It's the future. So somehow Pope Leo has to grapple with this and come to a peaceful solution. I hope it's something closer to Summorum Pontificum. But ahead of the President's State of the Union, Father, and in the wake of months of federal immigration enforcement in Minnesota and across the country, the U.S. Bishops' Conference issued what can only be described as an immigration policy wish list, calling on Congress to act against ICE enforcement. This is the same Bishops' Conference that received hundreds of millions of dollars of federal grants under the Biden years for refugee resettlement. Are their concerns purely pastoral here? And, Father, should they get out of the relocation of migrants and refugee business?
Well, I believe they largely added that because the funding evaporated for that. And also, since the border is now closed, there are no new waves of people needing to be resettled. And, you know, I'm not going to say the bishops don't have a right to comment on policy and all the rest, but it has to be balanced with a consideration of the kind of effects. If you say ICE enforcement should be suspended, well, the next question, well, what other law enforcement should be suspended? Because suspending the enforcement of law is going against the will of the American people, whose legislators enacted those laws. If we want to have a lawful society in which we respect the will of the people in a democracy, then enforce the laws, change the laws, lobby, etc. And on this matter, as we've said before on this show, there is no one single opinion that can say it represents Catholic teaching. Because as we know, there are many, many people waiting online to get in legally. Let's be concerned about them. They're the ones who should be given preference, not people try to enter illegally.
Bob, the bishops want to affirm human dignity here, which is their job, okay? But they don't mention the cartel trafficking, the criminal enterprises, and the violence against American citizens that some, not all, of these immigrants who are here illegally and just cross the border, they don't acknowledge any of that. Is it wrong to ignore the rank human tragedy and the loss of dignity stemming from unfettered immigration policy, where no one's watching the border or the shore?
Yeah, I think that that's the heart of the problem here, because they do say, you know, in passing, there are a few words about, of course, every country has a right to control its borders. But then, you know, that goes by the wayside, and there are all these things that are supposed to open up the situation in which we exist right now. And it's not only the criminality and that sort of immediate group of people who need to be deported. And I think largely ICE was doing that, at least at the beginning. There's a whole set of problems about the training of these ICE agents, because we brought so many of them in. And that's another part of this question. But the thing for me that I think that where they really fall down is they talk about the right to seek asylum. And there is such a thing. But there are particular rules, international rules, about what constitutes the way in which you seek asylum. What we saw under the Biden administration was just wholesale opening of the borders, allowing people, you know, giving people phones and telling them show up for an asylum hearing 2 years from now. I mean, that's not controlling a border. when you have millions of people who come along, it's not, again, only the criminality. All they speak as if everyone who then arrives here is a productive member of society. What about all the people who are being housed for free, fed for free, given free medical care? We already have people who are poor here in the United States, and we have a $35 trillion deficit, a national deficit, federal deficit. And what are we supposed to do about our own poor to begin with? So there are multiple questions about justice and what is correct and what respects human dignity of our own people already here, of the people who are coming here legally. And then I think it's in the third position that you talk about, well, what do you do when large numbers of people want to cross? I think you can open up the number that you're going to allow in, but to just speak blanketly as if everybody who's made it across the border is somehow to be protected, to be allowed to go to schools, to be allowed to go to hospitals, to come to church, this to me, it's just a small part of the question. It's not dealing with the entire question.
Yeah, no, they're all important points, and we will continue to look at this, examine it. I'm sure it won't go away. And be sure to check out this week's Prayerful Posse over on Arroyo Grande. We'll have a more in-depth discussion of these stories and many more. This corrupt bishop out in California and the Pope meditating this week on corruption in the church and much more. Robert Royal, Father Gerald Murray, thank you both as always. Cuba fires upon a U.S. vessel in Cuban waters, killing four. How will this affect already strained relations between the two countries? With his take, Florida Congressman Carlos Jimenez. Thank you so much for being with us, Congressman. I want to start with this incident in Cuba. I mean, Cuban border guards fired on and killed four people aboard a Florida-registered speedboat this week, wounding six others. Now, Cuba claims the passengers were armed Cuban Americans attempting to infiltrate the island. This comes as the Trump administration has virtually cut off all oil shipments to Cuba. First of all, Congressman, you're a member of the Homeland Security and House Armed Services Committee. What do we know about what happened, and do you believe they were trying to infiltrate the country?
I'm not sure what they were trying to do, but I know that some of the information given by the Cuban authorities already is false. One of the names that they've given is either dead or on the boat, is actually here in the United States, and he's fine. And so he doesn't know what they're talking about. He does know a lot of the people that have been named in that incident. The other thing, it wasn't a speedboat. It was a 24-foot open fisherman with a 1 300-horsepower engine on it. That is not a speedboat. That's just basically a fishing boat that many of us here in South Florida have. They changed their story that it was a human smuggling operation, and now it's an infiltration operation. So, again, I think Secretary of State Marco Rubio had it right. We're going to have to do our own investigation to figure out exactly what happened. We need to talk to those six individuals that are being held by the Cuban authorities. Supposedly they're injured and they're being given medical help. Our ambassador is trying to get access to them right now so that we can find out exactly what the heck is going on here.
Congressman, you called this a massacre. I mean, Cuba's Interior Ministry says that the men on that Florida-registered boat fired first and were there to conduct terrorism. I mean, here's a bigger question, and I realize the facts haven't all shaken out, but where does this leave U.S.-Cuba relations? And is there a risk that this could provoke or encourage more violence against American citizens in these waters?
Well, I think, look, the noose is tightening around the regime's neck, and so maybe the regime is getting desperate, and maybe this is one of the ways that they're going to try to, you know, somehow squirm their way out of this one. But they're playing with a different president, a different secretary of state. We've seen this movie before. We've seen what the Cuban regime has tried before, tried to squirm away, try to survive somehow, and I don't think it's going to happen this time with Secretary of State Rubio and President Trump. So is it a harbinger of things to come? Maybe. But every time they do something like that, all we need to do is squeeze more and squeeze more until we squeeze the life out of this regime and finally bring freedom to the people of Cuba and finally turn Cuba from a threat, a security threat of the United States into a friend of the United States. And that's what we need to do.
Well, I mean, look, the Trump administration has already choked off all the oil exports from Venezuela. Given what just happened in Venezuela, What do you think the Cuban regime, those running the country now, what is their perspective? Where do they think they're going to go with this kind of action?
Well, I think they're going to try to do the same thing they've done for the last 65 years, wait us out. And so what they do is they try to survive and then hope for a different administration that will then ease sanctions, et cetera, and give them an opportunity to breathe. The problem this time is that it used to be that the world would give relief to Cuba by extending credit, et cetera. But Cuba hasn't paid their debts. And so the world is now tired of giving Cuba all of this, all these gifts and loans and never getting paid back. So they're at the end of their rope. We need to choke them off and we need to move on to a new regime. We need to have the people of Cuba finally be free after 65 years. And we need to have Cuba a friend of the United States, not a foe of the United States. Cuba is the cancer, a cancer in this part of the world, in our hemisphere. And we have a lot of allies that say it's time to get rid of them because they spread all of this revolution and discord among our hemisphere. And frankly, a lot of our friends in our hemisphere are tired of it.
Congressman Carlos Jimenez, thank you for the insight. We'll have you back soon.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, the president's State of the Union was delivered this week in the midst of talks with Iran, the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war, and cartel chaos in Mexico. To help us make sense of it all, I'm joined by foreign policy expert and co-host of the War and Freedom podcast, Dr. Waleed Faris. Waleed, thanks for being here. At the State of the Union, the president did sort of a flyover of foreign policy. He mentioned Iran wanting a deal, a brief nod to Ukraine peace talks. But interestingly, he said almost nothing about China. Some critics are calling the speech light on strategy. Now, you've advised the president, including this one and others. When you heard this address, what was missing in your estimation?
Well, for those interested in what is our future with China, one point is clear. The president is obviously monitoring through his agencies the actions of the Chinese across the world, including in Latin America, but also in Africa and in Asia. But he wants to give a chance for in negotiations with China. Remember, they have a lot of our debt. They have trillions of dollars in cash.
Right.
So the movement he's doing regarding China is basically, let's see, let's wait and see. We are two giants. We are bigger than them economically, of course, but they are dangerous. They are nuclear. And for the time being, they are competing with us economically. The second point that is very important is, I'll go back to Iran in a second, but he actually mentioned the cartels fight in Mexico. That's huge. The signs that we're getting is that that battle in Mexico City and other cities as well inside Mexico could have happened inside the United States. The militia that we've seen, the way they are fighting, the way they are blowing up things inside Mexico could have happened here had this administration not been able to shut down, not been able to be elected first and shut down the border. See, now we see what could have happened in many states across the United States had we not ended this this bleeding. Demographic breeding that was coming from Mexico. And thirdly, of course, the issue of Iran, which is the name of the game now with all of these task forces heading and now deployed around Iran. The challenge is this. The administration, the president, that is trying to push the Islamic regime to give the maximum they can, and they are not giving. So there are limits to this. We cannot maintain those task forces. We're paying every day millions of dollars. And President Trump understands the business of it. So they have to answer or there will be action.
Yeah, well, I mean, Iran, the president said Iran can never have a nuclear weapon. He sent a second aircraft carrier to the region, dozens of additional fighter crafts. Dr. Faris, you warned about an Iran nuclear deal going wrong a full year before Obama signed that deal.
Yeah.
Where do you see this standoff headed? And are we days or maybe even hours away from military action?
Glad you mentioned the Obama nuclear deal with the Islamic regime in Iran, because we have a genome. We have what happened for the following 10 years. What happened is that the regime got the $150 billion. $150 billion. They bought all the weapons they want. They funded all the cells, all the militias. And until now, they have never changed their policy. So we have 10 years of material that would tell us now that this regime is going to lie. this regime is going to get benefits. And that's why we need to make a difference between when the U.S. sit down and negotiate with the EU, with Brazil, with India. It's economic. It's business. I mean, we can afford not having them coming immediately and doing exactly what we're doing, but not with the Islamic regime in Iran. They are gaining time. They are telling other things to the Arab world. They are preparing themselves to gain as much time that until we get into a problem, they believe somehow, Raymond, that we're going to have domestic problems coming closer to the midterm election. That's the real time.
I want to get your take on something you mentioned earlier, this cartel violence that erupted in Mexico. You told Iran International recently that the most important goal of Hezbollah was, in your words, to get to the American and Mexican border. The cartels right now are in open warfare following the killing of a top drug lord. Waleed, as the U.S. contemplates more strikes on Iran this week, what is the potential for blowback, not through the Middle East, but through our own southern border?
That has been my concern for years, since the first Iran deal, or the Iran deal, the Obama-Iran deal. See, Hezbollah, since the establishment of the Islamic regime in Iran, out of Lebanon, because Hezbollah controls parts of Lebanon, most of it for certain years, they have followed the Lebanese communities around the world, and there is a sizable one in Venezuela. And many of them go back, are coming from the Shia communities in Lebanon. Not that these communities are responsible, but Hezbollah penetrates those communities and they establish themselves. Hezbollah as a militia and the IRGC established themselves in Venezuela. They had headquarters in Caracas. They controlled a lot of actions in Margarita Island, so on and so forth. And they also spread out throughout Latin America. But the most important country that they were working on penetrating is Mexico, because Mexico has the cartels and Hezbollah is in the business of drug trade, and therefore their real goal, as you just mentioned, is to get to our border and penetrate our country. And my concern, really, yes, thank God we have the Trump administration that shut down the border, but how many got in is the biggest question.
In the State of the Union, the president made quick reference to the ongoing peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine. Now, Putin is still demanding Ukraine concede territory it actually holds. Zelensky says the White House has privately set a June deadline. Now, Waleed, you've advised European Parliament as well as the Congress on transatlantic security. Is Trump's strategy for ending this war one that can actually work? Or will it only embolden our adversaries like China and Iran?
A good question. Actually, the Trump approach, if I understand it well, is dual regarding the ending of that war. He started by pressuring President Zelensky. Remember the scene at the White House, so on and so forth, right, to a point where the Ukrainians now realize, okay, we have to have a concession if we want to stop the war and be free. And the Europeans are backing that. But the Russian leadership, the Kremlin, is saying, no, they are encouraged and saying, oh, Trump will help us obtain eastern Ukraine and the Crimean Peninsula. But then we could do a more than this by pressuring the Ukrainians to not integrate the EU, not to go to NATO. Trump said no. And the second track that the president has adopted, which is not very well known by the public, he has also provided the carrot, the stick from one side and the carrot. He has, according to sources, offered, if not himself, but people who relate to him, a super deal between the United States and Russia, if Russia withdraws from Ukraine, that would cover the entire Siberia and Alaska. And there are projects now, the tunnel between Alaska and Siberia. That, according to experts, could cover the amount of $20 trillion, 10 times more than what he obtained in the Gulf. So obviously the elite in Russia is very interested in money and therefore in their project. And they are putting pressure on the leadership in Russia to tell them, well, just accept whatever has been offered. That's more than you ever gonna get. And then leave Ukraine to be free to be the European Union. And I think the president is banking on the fact that inside Russia, people would be interested in investment of that sort guaranteed by the United States. I'm going to put pressure on the president of Russia and tell him, let's end that war.
Waleed Faraz, always fascinating talking with you. Waleed wrote the book, Iran, an Imperialist Republican U.S. Policy. It's still available at bookstores everywhere and online. Waleed Faraz, thank you.
Thank you.
And over on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I sat down with blues rock guitar legend Kenny Wayne Shepherd. We talked about the enduring power of musical tradition and the threat that AI poses to artists that you love and musicians, and carrying the blues forward, the traditional blues, to the next generation. Do you feel an obligation to carry that tradition forward?
Well, what I feel like is my responsibility, and not everybody feels this way, but it's the example I was given, is that I feel obligated to give credit where credit is due. So I didn't invent this. None of us have invented any of this, right?
Right.
Everybody's music that they are inspired to create has been inspired by something someone else did before them. Mm-hmm. And my obligation, I believe, is not to sit here and pretend like I invented something, but instead to the people who look to me and appreciate what I do, to say, hey, but did you hear about this guy? Have you heard this woman's music? Have you heard this artist, this band? Because this got me fired up, and that's what inspired me to do this. So turn them on to that. And people like Stevie Ray Vaughan and Jimi Hendrix and all those guys, they did that as well.
Yeah,
you know, and then that helped me go back and research and discover so many more artists, because it opened my eyes to this entire new world of artists.
You're the father of six children.
Yeah.
A convert to Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
Did that change and deepen your work in any way?
Well, it changed.
Both of those things.
Well, yeah. Well, having a family and six children.
That'll wake you up fast.
Well, it provides an entirely new sense of motivation, mm-hmm. and inspiration, because I want to make my kids proud.
Yeah.
I want to, you know, when you're in a position like this, you can leave behind a lot. You can leave behind a lot of wreckage,
yeah.
or you can leave behind a legacy,
yeah.
or you can leave a little bit of both. But my intention is to leave at least just the impression that through my music, that people felt something, mm. and I had a positive impact on their lives, and therefore my kids can be proud of that.
Mm.
And I can show my kids what hard work and dedication looks like and what the payoff for that is.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with Kenny Wayne Shepherd is on YouTube, at Arroyo Grande Show, or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an Arroyo Grande Show. And be on the lookout for Saturday's installment of the Prayerful Posse. Never a dull moment. We had a little technical delay, so it's a day late. But you'll enjoy it nonetheless. Go to Arroyo Grande Show wherever you get your podcasts. This week, as the nation watched President Trump deliver the longest State of the Union address in American history, one of the most poignant images in that chamber was a young woman sitting in the gallery carrying the weight most of us can only imagine. Claire Lai, the daughter of Jimmy Lai, the 78-year-old devout Catholic Apple Daily founder and democracy advocate who just 2 weeks ago was sentenced to 20 years in a Hong Kong maximum security prison, was present. Claire was the guest of House Speaker Mike Johnson. She's here tonight with co-chair of the Congressional Executive Committee on China, Congressman Chris Smith, to update us on Jimmy's condition and the status of the diplomatic efforts on his behalf. Congressman Smith, Claire, thank you both for being here. Claire, I want to begin with you. Speaker Johnson called your presence at the State of the Union a symbol of America's determination to secure your father's release. When you were sitting in that gallery and the whole world was watching, what was going through your mind?
I mean, firstly, I am so extremely grateful to Speaker Johnson and to Congressman Smith and Mrs. Smith for being able to attend the State of the Union that day. I mean, it was such a privilege to be there for such a significant event. And I mean, what a beautiful address it was. So many people were honored who very much deserved it, and to have received such high praises from so many people and so much support really does mean the world. And just really across the political aisle, we have received so much support. I mean, from President Trump and his administration, from the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and just also, I mean, like Congressman Molinar and so on, and Senator Rick Scott. I mean, we've just received such a huge amount of support, and we are just so extremely humbled and grateful for it.
Well, Claire, when your father smiled and waved at supporters when he arrived at that sentencing on February 9th, you described that sentence as heartbreakingly cruel. Are you hearing anything on the diplomatic front that's giving you and your family hope?
President Trump has mentioned my father a number of times, and on the day of the sentencing, Secretary of State Rubio did put out an extremely strong statement condemning it and asking for his humanitarian release. So we haven't heard what will happen in the upcoming trip, but it does give us cause for hope. And I think if anything, my father's cases have proven that the rule of law in Hong Kong is completely broken, and any solution now has to be a diplomatic, sovereign to sovereign one.
Mm-hmm. Congressman Smith, with President Trump going to Beijing in April, I mean, Claire just referenced it. How crucial is this moment to make some kind of progress toward Jimmy's release? And what can the president do, aside from raising Jimmy Lai's case again, personally, to Xi, which he's done in the past?
Well, I think this is an opportunity like no other. They got the conviction, which was a false conviction. He is guilty of nothing. But he is very ill. He's 78 years old. He got 20 years, which means it is a life sentence. And I have to say that Claire has been an amazing advocate for her dad. Sebastian, in like manner, has also been tenacious throughout the world, as was Claire, is Claire. And I tell you, the way she was greeted on Capitol Hill by so many lawmakers, starting with the Speaker, who is an absolute friend and advocate for Jimmy Lai, and she did. She just was amazing. When he is free, he'll have his two wonderful children to thank, especially for that liberation. And I do believe, I believe it strongly, that President Trump, who has freed prisoners in Lukashenko's gulags in Belarus, he's gotten prisoners out all over the world. This is, like the quintessential example of what a president can do. It's humanitarian. He is sick. And he ought to be free. And again, Xi Jinping, listen to his daughter, to Jimmy Lai's daughter. Just look her in the eyes. She's just a wonderful person. Again, like Sebastian, his son, the two of them, and what advocates. They're just amazing.
Yeah. Congressman, you also serve on the Committee on Foreign Affairs.
Yes.
Secretary Rubio, as Claire mentioned, called the sentence of Jimmy Lai an unjust and tragic conclusion.
Yes.
What are you hearing from the State Department about the diplomatic tools at their disposal right now? And is London in the mix, given that Jimmy Lai is a British citizen?
Great question. We have conveyed to the president and to the Secretary of State incredible tools that can be used. I'm the author of the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. I introduced it back in 2014 when the Umbrella Revolution started. Both Marco Rubio and I got the bill passed. It is law. There are all kinds of sanctions that can be deployed because of the ongoing cruelty against not just Jimmy Lai, but all kinds of other amazing democracy advocates, Joshua Wong and the others. So the president, I think, we would greet with great happiness and joy to release a Jimmy Lai, but we want systemic change. There needs to be a recognition that human rights are universal. And Hong Kong, of all places, used to be a place where the Basic Law and the Sino-UK Treaty made it very clear that they had human rights that very much paralleled our own here in the United States. And as for the Prime Minister of the UK, he needs to do more. When Sebastian testified at my hearing in 2023, he made an appeal to the UK government, because Jimmy Lai is a UK citizen, to do something. And, he wrote a very strong letter. They need to go into hyperdrive to say, free this great man. He is sick. And frankly, the ongoing incarceration brings nothing but dishonor to the Chinese Communist Party. This would be at least a step in the right direction. And, big steps are usually preceded by smaller steps. Maybe good things can happen if Xi Jinping does release him. And I do think nobody is better to do that than Donald Trump.
Claire, Congressman Smith mentioned this a bit earlier, but your father's health is deteriorating. His own legal team appealed to the UN Special Rapporteur on torture over his treatment. Is he still being denied the sacraments? Do you know?
Gosh, so, The Hong Kong government's position is that he gets it regularly. I mean, for our position is that he gets it extremely, extremely intermittently. I mean, to be precise in numbers, he got it 11 times over the course of 2.5 years. I mean, under no definition should that be considered regular. At least one should get it at least 52 times a year, and that's over 2.5 years. That is completely ridiculous.
Yeah. Congressman Jimmy Lai was convicted in part for meeting with American politicians like yourself.
Yes.
Beijing essentially criminalized contact with the U.S. Congress. If we allow that kind of precedent to stand without any pushback or consequence, what does it mean for every democracy advocate, journalist, Catholic bishop in that part of the world who looks to America as a defender of freedom and an ally?
Well, it'll mean that the best and the bravest and the brightest in China will be hermetically sealed from all contact with anyone who is like-minded on democracy and human rights. And that will be an awful loss. You know, injustice need not be forever. Someday, China will be free, and it will be because of men and women, but men like Jimmy Lai, who sacrificed just about everything in order to procure those freedoms. And so we need to push back very hard. The national security law, which is a travesty, means, like you said, any kind of contact with an American will be rewarded with punishment, especially with long prison sentences. I left X. I was on Twitter. I left it in large part because of the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. I had 15,000 followers in Hong Kong. I was very fearful that the Chinese Communist Party would take their names and use that as part of their charging document. So it's really, you know, what do they get out of this? Hong Kong used to be an economic miracle. Human rights, they have a thing called the Basic Law that looks just like our Bill of Rights. It wasn't perfect. We're not perfect either. But it at least recognized they had real due process rights. All of it's gone. And now they want to impose that on Taiwan. And frankly, that's why the ASEAN countries are so worried. They want to extend it to other nations as well. We need to stand up strong. And, you know, our president has so many levers at his, and he'll use them, including sanctions. China is an exporting country. They don't survive economically if they don't send their products to the West, especially to the U.S. We need to link human rights with trade. And I have a bill that would do just that. And short of that, there are all kinds of other sanctions, including Magnitsky sanctions, that can be levied on individuals who are committing atrocities in China.
Yeah. Claire, as I was listening to you both, I thought, if you had an opportunity to speak directly to President Trump tonight and to Prime Minister Keir Starmer, what would you say to them?
I mean, I would say that my father, I mean, what my father stood for are values that are shared in America, values that are shared in the UK. Actually, I mean, what he stood for was essentially the agreement that was made between the UK and China, and an agreement that the Chinese side breached. And he is paying the price for that. And right now, China has the opportunity to do the only just and only honorable thing, which is to release my father, my aging father in poor health, so that he can spend his remaining days with his family and serving our Lord, and which is all he wants to do.
Congressman Smith, I guess the real question to my mind is, didn't we know when the UK handed Hong Kong back to the Chinese that this inevitably would happen, that they would, you know, that Hong Kong could not be its own island of freedom in the midst of this great colossus? Didn't we know that back in the 90s?
That is a great question. You know, in 2014, as the umbrella revolution was taking shape, I introduced the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. And I had all kinds of people in this town who said it was misguided. There's no way that Xi Jinping would ever cause anything but the status quo to continue. One, he was bound by, as Claire said, by a treaty that he signed into that the Chinese Party signed into willingly with the UK. It was supposed to be unchanged for 50 years. Well, that didn't happen. And the Basic Law, again, was their most fundamental set of freedoms. And I said, people who say that's not going to happen don't know Xi Jinping. You know, around 2014, he began the genocide against the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. And the people at the Olympic Committee turned a blind eye. We raised all of that back then. But there was concern that there's no way that he's going to allow freedom to flourish when they do nothing but crush it on the mainland. Added to that, just one thing about Jimmy Lai, he loves our Blessed Mother so much. And has such a devotion to Our Lady. And he also is a great follower and loves Fulton Sheen, who all of us find. I do. I've read 5 of his books. I just can't believe how great he is. So we were talking about a great Catholic, a great Christian, a great father. And you see, I told Sebastian, I say it to Claire, the apple did not fall far from the tree. They are just such noble people. And that's the kind of people that we need to rally around. And thankfully, I do believe President Trump and Marco Rubio will do it.
Well, Claire Lai, Congressman Chris Smith, we're grateful to you both. And we will continue to keep Jimmy Lai and your entire family, Claire, in our prayers and certainly update our audience on this story.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
There's a remarkable production opening next week in the U.S., Bernadette the Musical. And it's not your typical story of a saint. Now, this week, I'll bring you some of my conversation with Hollywood legend Kelsey Grammer, who signed on to Bernadette as a co-lead producer. I didn't realize he produced other shows on Broadway. The show premieres February 19th in Chicago, but it's running in previews. Kelsey told me Bernadette, the musical, was such a unique and personal project for him. Take a look. Just to bring all of this full circle, you produced The Color Purple, won a Tony Award for it.
Yeah.
I know you were one of the many esteemed people who produced The Color Purple. But you do have credentials in the producing space. Mm-hmm. You recently saw this musical, Bernadette.
Right.
What did you think when you saw it?
It's an extraordinary thing. I mean, it's this young woman is, it's like a visit with Saint Bernadette. I mean, for whatever reason, they found this magnificent young woman. But so did Saint Bernadette.
Exactly.
It's like they are walking along together, and it's remarkable. And you feel like you're looking right into her eyes from, you know, the back of the house. I mean, it's something. So,
did you feel Karen when you watched it the first time? Because that's what occurred to me as I read it.
Interesting. That's an interesting thought. Not necessarily. It's specific unto itself. Mm-hmm. That this saint is she's remarkable and still remarkable. Apparently, I mean, she's I don't know what they call that when the corpse doesn't rot.
I mean, incorruptible.
She's that.
She's still incorruptible.
I mean, that's,
have you seen the body?
No, I haven't, but I've seen pictures. Oh. It's like, you got to be kidding. I mean, it's like, so there is, you know.
Yeah. I mean, the Lord.
This ain't Lenin's tomb. This is the real deal.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. This isn't the waxworks.
Yeah.
Have you been to Lourdes?
I have not.
Wow.
I've only been to France twice, and you know, for you know, film stuff.
Being a producer, you have to go to Lourdes. Yeah. But for those who don't know, for those who might be unaware, this is a 14-year-old girl receives this message from this lady, the Virgin Mary, and she's tortured over this truth that she has to witness to. How and why did that resonate with you, Kelsey, at this point in your life?
What resonated with me for this particular show is this young woman's performance is extraordinary, but also the resolve and the innocence and the simple beauty of just claiming who you are and stating clearly, I'm not lying. You can tell me I am, but I'm not. I'm not going to change my story based upon whatever you throw at me. I'm steadfast, as I've been reminded by some of my co-producers of a word I said about her some time ago. Steadfast in her belief, in her faith, and in herself, in her own stature. This barely young woman stands in the face of all kinds of things and doesn't even resist, really, just says, this is the truth.
Yeah.
And that's remarkable.
It's the life I live, so why me? I
Bernadette, the musical premieres on February 19th. Previews begin this week on February 12th at the Athenaeum Center in Chicago, Illinois, before starting its national run across the U.S. For tickets and showtimes in Chicago and all the other stops, visit BernadetteTheMusical.com. And you can watch my full interview with Kelsey Grammer on the Arroyo Grande Show podcast. That's at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.